And what that does is that it allows us to see the divinity within the multiplicity of humanity, that every human in every shade and every color and every orientation and every gender and every inclination are all facets, all faces of the divine. And the more we can explore and the more we can embrace and the more we can experience our collective humanity, the more experiencing our collective divinity.
This is the Beware How show, mystic philosophy made practical. There are many paths up the mountain, and we're just pointing at a few of them. I'm Bob Peck, speaking with Scott Stanley, Ryan Padgett, and Melina Kiriaki. We are conscious creatives and formerly closeted mystics trying to unpack the inaccessible. According to the mystics, the truth cannot be spoken, but we'll try to talk about it anyway. Hi, I'm Bob Peck, and this is the Beware How Show, speaking regularly with Scott Stanley, Ryan Padgett, and Melina Kiriaki. The Beware How Show covers mystic philosophy made practical. We like mindfulness, metaphysics, and non-duality. And a big part of this show is untangling misconceptions about spirituality. So how fitting that our guest today, on Sunday, February 7th, is Zevi Slavin, of Secrets of Unity. Zevi is a Jewish mystic, a Hasidic Jew, and content creator of the channel Secrets of Unity on YouTube. Zevi grew up in Australia, moved to Los Angeles when he was 18, lived in New York, Cape Town, South Africa, and now in Israel. He's dedicated to illuminating the faith traditions across the world, through an Abrahamic lens, but an Eastern lens. He talks about philosophy and many disciplines of different ideologies on his channel. Thrilled to have you, Zevi. Thank you for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I've been waiting a long time, and it's really so, so great to be with you guys. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, starting just with gratitude for your work, man. It's been really wonderful to go through your videos these past probably 6 months, I think, is when I started listening to you. Via interview with a Sufi was my way in with your work, and that was so beautiful. But I even like, is Schopenhauer a Buddhist? There's just a lot of really great content on Secrets of Unity that we've all been delving into. And I just thought, you know, I wanted to start with gratitude, and then I wanted to start out with the just the idea, and we were just touching on this, but the idea that books, words don't have it. So let's talk about it. And cite a bunch of books, right? That's what we're gonna do. Acknowledging that they're, faulty, futile attempts at. Jump in, Zevi, on kind of your background. Really, we'll get into existential philosophical realizations. Like, we'd love for you to walk us through Hasidic Judaism a bit and like Jewish mysticism. First, just tell us kind of how you got started making content and kind of how you got to where you are.
Yeah, firstly, I'm really grateful for that gratitude, because a lot of the work being a content creator is done like alone and in private behind closed doors. And like, so seldom do you actually get to like meet face to face with the people that are appreciating and enjoying what you're making. And it's like usually just numbers and like short like messages, but to actually like sit down and to like talk with people that have been engaging both with like what you've been creating and creating themselves incredible content, which I've also been enjoying, is really, really such a blessing. And like, particularly now, like during this lockdown era that we live in, to actually sit like virtually face to face is a real, real blessing. So thank you first. I'm deeply grateful for that.
Beautiful.
My name is Zevi. I was born in Sydney, Australia, just near the beach, Bondi. And I grew up in a Hasidic community, which for those that know is a very insular, old school, old world type of Judaism, which is very traditional in its values and very centered around family and living a meaningful life and a very God-centered life, very text-based because it's, a traditional Jewish place as well. And actually, I'm pretty dyslexic. I don't know if that comes across in any of my videos, but growing up dyslexic in the community is a challenge. And I kind of found creative ways to go around thinking and learning and eventually teaching, which I really enjoyed. It's my real passion. And I don't know how much detail you want, but you're welcome to like ask about any part of the story. But I went through, in terms of like my spiritual journey, how I got to where I am today, in like relation to this conversation, there must have been like a very there was a very high period in my like spiritual life when I was like 13, 14, 15, post like the bar mitzvah. You know, you're like on this real high. You're like now a real, which very
I'm a
exciting.
man now,
I'm a real man, and
so.
now like all of the mitzvot, all of like the good deeds that I do actually count. Before it was just practice. It's very exciting. And prayer is a big part of the Hasidic community, and you're learning what it means to actually pray, to actually, be centered and to find silence in a crazy world, in a crazy life. But then about like at 16 or 17, things began to lose their steam, and things started to like not really click for me anymore. And I was slipping a little from like, it, and I didn't, none of it was shown externally. It was all very an internal process. And I encountered just by chance, just like actually through a novel that was laying around in the dorm room that I was in. I was traveling. I left home when I was 18, and I was travel as you mentioned. I was in the States and whatnot, and I came across this novel from Dan Brown. Actually, it was Lost Symbol. I'm almost embarrassed because it's such a popular author, but I
No
mean there are many
judgment.
messages. There are many ways to the one, and he was
It's
bringing basic
obscure
like
Dan
heavy.
Brown, by the way. It's
Oh yeah,
not
it's not.
a Tom Hanks movie, Dan Brown.
Exactly. That gives me a bit of respite. And he had just like basic ideas from like basic biblical Christian mysticism, some very like basic Eastern, like early church father stuff. And I was reading it, and it was so bizarre to me, because the stuff that he was talking about in this novel of his was literally the same things that I had been learning that morning and that evening in my like very Hasidic Orthodox school, where I was studying Hasidut, which is like in some ways the modern brainchild of Kabbalah. We get more into the genealogy of that, of course. And I was like, how on earth does Dan Brown know what's happening in like my Hasidic class? And why is he writing about this as if it's Christian mystics? These are our ideas. Like, what on earth is going on here? And the Christian for the Jew is like the ultimate other, right? It's like the antithesis. And historically there's been a lot of distance and antipathy and enmity, of course, between the two. And it was a very surreal experience, very bizarre. And then I kind of put that on the back shelf, and I left it alone. And I got interested in other things, and my Talmudic studies became more important to me. And I was off studying. I was in Cape Town, and then I started teaching. I was teaching philosophy, Jewish philosophy, and then I started to like pick up notes of Eastern philosophy, because I was trying to give like an introduction to philosophy and then get more specific in Jewish philosophy. And as I begin reading these Eastern thinkers, I'm like, hold up, they're also talking about the same things that like the Christian mystics and like my own tradition is talking about. Like, wait a minute. And that's basically how I discovered like perennialism. It's how I discovered like that the fact that the mystics are speaking universal truth. And that led me, of course, to William James and Aldous Huxley and Meister Eckhart and Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross and Ibn Arabi and
Then
Nagarjuna.
you're
We could go
in.
on and
Then there's
on.
no going back.
And there's no yeah there was no going back for me, and it was it really changed me as well, because at the time as well, like, getting into philosophy isn't always the healthiest thing to do. Philosophy students aren't always the happiest people on the block. And I was like deep into the existentialists. I was deep into like your Sartre and Camus and like your Kant, and I was really trying to like get to something, and they weren't giving me any meaning or any like any hope or any inspiration. And then
And then you read
coming
The
across,
Idealists.
and then and reading the idealists as well, like reading the Germans, reading Hegel and Fichte and Schelling, and love to get into that as well. And then and seeing kind of how there's an alternative philosophy here. There's a philosophy which is equally rigorous and equally systematic and equally compelling and equally like challenging intellectually, but it's also deeply gratifying spiritually and deeply gratifying emotionally and deeply positive and hopeful on an ethical level. And I was like, this is incredible. And it turns out that this is what I was taught as a child from day one, and it wasn't anything other than my own heritage, just now seen in a universal lens. And ever since then, I've basically been obsessed with, I don't know what you want to call it, philosophical mysticism, comparative mysticism, perennialistic mysticism, whatever it is.
Beautiful.
And that's what I've basically
Beautiful.
given myself to.
I almost introduced you as a perennialist because I really think of you as more of that than even a Hasidic. But
I'm
beautiful, yeah.
comfortable to identify as a perennialist, and I know it's a contentious term for those that know the field, and I'm happy to take the heat and to go at it.
Hear, hear. No, that was beautiful. I'm so glad you had that realization. And, you know, I think we've had those in some capacity ourselves, you know, noticing that Meister Eckhart reads like the Vedas and, you know, mm-hmm. Thich Nhat Hanh sounds like, you know, Byron Katie. And there's this universality, and you do such a great job on your show. I mean, to point to Seekers of Unity, of like intellectualizing and like the concepts, and even your show and your website has a map of mystic paths. And it's something that I want to collaborate with you on. We talked about this, like the visualization of like the ideologies is really interesting to me, and just kind of like to the team. We talk a lot about, well, you and I even talked about this too a couple months ago, about mindfulness, metaphysics, and non-duality, and kind of like seeing spiritual paths through at least those three lenses, almost like as a Venn diagram, because there is universality, but there's slight differences. And you know, maybe that's a good place to start in terms of, you know, in mysticism and in mystical Judaism, from my understanding, is the way I look at mysticism and Abrahamic mysticism is you have kind of institutional and mystical. And, you know, it's fairly a dichotomy there. It's, you know, it's most clear in Christianity, probably, to me. Whereas, you know, it's like rules and regulations is institutional and like things you can't do. And then the mystics are more free flowing, poetic, expressive, etc. And that doesn't seem to be the case with Jewish mysticism. So talk to us about that, as far as like walking mm-hmm. us through, you know, like Hasidism being descended from Kabbalah seems like almost antithetical.
Yeah, it's
like
it's like counterintuitive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a really great observation. And I want to address it. I just want to address something that you mentioned earlier in getting to your question, which was that a lot of what I'm doing at my channel is very intellectualized, and some may say it's over intellectualized, which is definitely a valid critique. And I think that there are many paths within mysticism, and some are more intellectual and some are more experiential or practical, and they're all equally valid. I think what I'm trying to do specifically over my channel is to actually rework the idea of mysticism in the public conscious. So when people hear mysticism, what do they think? Most people think, I actually did a video right when I started the channel. I went down to the beach and asked people, what is mysticism mean to you?
Yeah.
And most people, most people think it means like
magic.
It's woo-hoo, it's magic, it's floppy thinking, it's like not, you know, it's like being unrealistic about the world, it's escapism. People have all kinds of ideas. And what I want to show is, and I hope that we get to, you know, what I want to show is that mysticism is actually something which has a very compelling case to be made for someone with all of their brain cells intact. And someone could be of the highest caliber, actually, someone could be a genius and could still be thoroughly convinced in the veracity and the verticality and the utility of mysticism.
Hey,
and
that's the best minds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why when I'm discussing mysticism, I'm turning to people like William James, to Bertrand Russell, to Hegel, to the best minds the East and West has produced. So that's sort of on a response to in response to your question, Jewish mysticism is an anomaly in that sense. And a very good point to mention here from the onset of the conversation is that universality does not mean uniformity. And unity is not here to eradicate differences. Differences are beautiful. Differences is what makes us who we are, and we're supposed to be who we are. We're not supposed to all melt into one big melting pot where nothing else is distinguishable. There's space for that. There's a moment for that too. And Jewish mysticism has a strata, two forms of unity, higher and lower unity, but there's an importance to maintain the identity and the difference. And the difference in identity among
diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I would just quickly interject there even too to add In Course in Miracles, which is a book that we're familiar with and I've read for a long time, is you know, esoteric spiritual book. It says form and content. Mm. Like the form is different, the content's the same. Like the framework is unique in that it has all those different external factors, but the content is one. You know? Yeah.
That's an interesting I want to put a pin on that and get back to it because
Beautiful.
philosophically, many people say that form is content and content is form, right? And that's both a modern and ancient idea. But we'll hold
Not
that
the
off.
non-dualists.
You can't beat them. So the Jewish mystics have this interesting relationship with authority, and there's a contemporary notion that's emerged in the recent study of mysticism in the past 50 years or so, which that the mystic is this heterodoxical, you know, like he's an aberrant from the tradition, he or she is an aberrant from the tradition. They're either amoral or they're
right.
Antinomian. They don't
the wine drinker Sufis or you know.
Yeah. And there's a romanticization of the mystic as such that's been done. And this is not true in there is true in some cases. I mean it didn't appear out of nowhere, but in many cases it's not true. And it's particularly not true in Jewish mysticism. In Jewish mysticism, typically the Kabbalist, which is basically Jewish mysticism as far as historians date it from the 13th century onwards, and there's earlier forms before and after, but from the 13th century onwards, where we can clearly begin to identify who is the mystic, because up until then it's a bit lost who exactly is the mystic. The Kabbalist is also at the same time the halachist, which means that he's the jurist of the law. It would be the equivalent to someone who's doing canon law in Christianity or Sharia in Islam. He typically, unfortunately, it's too often men, and I made a video on the channel talking about a handful of Jewish female mystics, but they're very much the exception. Typically, he's also the leader of the community in terms of foreign matters, dealing with you know the government and dealing with just general matters of welfare. And it was never really a character who was a total ascetic, a total monk who was detached from life. It was someone who was married, with children, with a job. It was very often people who were at the same time physicians and scientists and you know a bunch of other things and there were people who were deeply committed to Jewish practice, and they were the ones who are upholding and teaching and espousing Jewish practice. And why this isn't Jewish, just to give some historical examples, the greatest work of Jewish law that's practiced by Jews across the world today is the Shulchan Aruch, which is a 17th century work, which was written up in northern Palestine, Sfat at the time. And the author who writes it, Yosef Cairo, is a serious, serious mystic. He's a student of Isaac Luria, who was one of the greatest mystics in Jewish history. And he's a man who, besides writing this phenomenal compendium of scholarly work, of you know, halachic, of legal treaties, which is so minute and so, you have to be such a genius to master all of Jewish law, to write a work of law that's going to be binding for hundreds of years. He's also having like visions and ecstatic experiences, and he's having these magidim, like these angelic beings coming in and teaching him things. It's like he's an incredible mystic, and this is the norm in Jewish mysticism, that the halachic, that the legal mind and the mystical mind are their same mind, and
super anomaly in world traditions.
Yeah, fascinating.
Super cool.
And the reason, perhaps, and he's not an exception. He is the rule, like the Ravid. I can go on. I mean, the Ravid, another great, great mystic, is also someone who's writing hundreds of halachic responses that we still use until today. Halacha again is Jewish law. And the reason, what's very fascinating here is that I'm actually very interested in asking of each tradition, what does this mystical tradition have to offer to the world, unique from all the other traditions, right? What's the unique message that I can get from the Protestant mystic? What's the unique idea I can take from the Vedantic? What's the unique idea I can take from the Native American? And I think that's a beautiful question. And I think in Judaism, I would have to venture that one of the unique contributions of Jewish mysticism is its non-dual capacity to unite the body and soul, to unite the mind and the spirit, to unite the duty and the ecstasy. And it's particularly, it's the wisdom of Judaism and the wisdom of Torah to find the most ecstatic nearness and closeness and unification with the divine in the most seemingly mundane items and objects and moments and realities. And it's so counter-escapist, it's so here and now. Without getting technical, there was a big debate about Hasidism between Gershon Scholem and Martin Buber, two great, great scholars, and they were basically arguing about how much of an immanentist was the Hasidic mystic. How actually present were they in the world? But the fundamental agreement is that for the Hasidic Jew, for the Hasidic mystic, which is the most popular form of mysticism today, It's God in nature. It's God in family. It's God in duty. It's God in the dishes, in the laundry. And that's an idea which is not exclusive to Jewish mysticism. Once you see this, you can begin to see it in other traditions. And I'm sure, you know, there's coming to mind Zen and Rensdai and Pure Land where you see this idea as well. But it's such a fundamental idea that rides throughout Jewish history, that the spirit must be attached to the body, or else it's just a ghost, and the body without spirit is just a corpse, and you need them together as one and not as two separate things. And I think that perhaps may answer the question.
Yep, beautifully said. Yeah. Absolutely does. I think there is certainly this escapist kind of dismissive attitude in some, more so in religious circles. Secular circles, I think, are less concerned about the difference between institutional and mystic, but in religious institutional circles, definitely dismissive and even blasphemous, I mean, in some qualities, right? You know, Mansur al-Halaj, Anil Haq, and, you know, this Muslim saint who said, "I am truth," basically, if you're not familiar. And he was in such bliss that he danced to the gallows in chains, being killed for heresy. And, you know, there's a lot of division between institutional and mystical, and really, I think, more even so in Islam and Christianity. It's really refreshing to hear the kind of pragmatic combination within Judaism, and it's feels very Eastern to me. It's something that we talk a lot about on this show, as far as you know, even really the great Hindu gurus, which is kind of where I go and who I have piled up next to the and within reach to pull out and read if necessary here. But you know, Yogananda, Sri Ramana Maharshi, you know, all these guys, Ramakrishna, all these guys were kind of countering this escapist misunderstanding around spirituality that, you know, that's the common view, is like, you go, oh, you want to be spiritual? Go off to the Himalayas and sit in a cave. And that ain't it. You know, your duty, your dharma, your sadhana is your life, what you're here to do, your responsibilities in your community, to your family, to your country, to your world. So yeah, I hear that.
Which is not to say, by the way, that there aren't cases of heretical mystics and escapist mystics in Jewish history. There, we do have you know, periods of,
you gotta have a few.
sure. I mean, it's a long history. So we have asceticists who do escape sometimes. We have that from the Second Temple period all the way up until the 18th and 19th century. You have the Prushim of the 19th century, and you have the Essenes of the Second Temple period. And everything in between. And you have mystics in Jewish history who are heretical. I mean, the best example is Shabtai Tzvi, who goes off and becomes an apostate and converts to Islam, claims that he's the Messiah. It's a very, very traumatic moment in Jewish history. And his disciples that continue that tradition, Jacob Frank and whatnot. So there are, but those are really, really exceptions, and they're not held up as paradigms of the mystical tradition, and they're seen really as the dangers and the and sort of the warning signs of where mysticism can go wrong, not where it goes right. But the idea of coming back to the here and now, I mean, the famous 10 ox herding icons, that the final icon is that the ox is back there in full, right? The idea, and what Jewish mysticism may do in a way, and I would love to actually do a further dive to see if this is done in Hinduism, where there's a very, very intimate weaving. See, the Jew historically, without being stereotypical, is like over-intellectualized and is over-bookish and is over-wordy, like we're the people of the book, right? That's how we're known. And the systems that we build are become very, very complex and very intricate. And to the outsider, they seem very convoluted. And in sort of these minutiae upon minutiae upon minutiae of detail. And what the Jewish mystics do in a very fascinating way is that they take the full, and that happens both in the mystical traditions and in the legalistic traditions. So both in Jewish law, like the absolute minutiae, but it's like if this happens and this happens and that didn't happen, like, but if that happened and this happened and this didn't happen, then this happened. It's like very like you'd have to do these mental like acrobatics to find out where the
conditional applications.
Huge. It's like insane. And the same thing happened in the Kabbalistic world, where like their theosophies become so intense and the levels become so multitudinous and the relationships between them become so complex. And then you have to begin comparing systems and seeing like where the contradictions and why. And it's like really, and
what I'm stressed right now with you even like explaining.
and what these mystics do is that they manage to take the full complexity of the mystical system and the full complexity of the legalistic system and marry them perfectly so that that the exact minutiae in one matches up to the exact minutiae in another one. And when you're doing like X within the legalistic practice or the ritualistic practice, you're supposed to be meditating on exactly X, Y, and Z to correspond with that. And it's a very, very sophisticated, high-level integration, which really doesn't allow there to be any space to escape the marriage between soul and body. That point may be a bit much, but it's a very fascinating.
Oh, it's helpful.
We're with you.
Good.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I was also your video about I think it was specifically about the Zohar, but you were talking about one of the other. From my point of view, one of the big differences of Jewish mysticism is I've heard a lot about the idea of the divine within the human, and that's kind of something that the mystics bring forward. But you were saying that it kind of takes that a step further, and it says that the idea of God very much relies on the consciousness of humans because we're the developing the soul to or you know that relationship in our life, and it almost elevated us to a different level that I had never heard in other forms of mysticism. So I was curious about that.
So I'm super fascinated. I always have been, really, from the beginning of my search, in this notion of the deification of the human, or the apotheosis, the theosis, the henosis. It gets all different terms, different traditions, where the human itself becomes the locus of divinity, where there's no longer like the divine somewhere up out there and the human down here, but the human in her full manifestation of her own humanity, or his humanity, is the full manifestation of the divine. It's the divine made conscious. I don't think it would be fair to say that's an idea that's unique to Jewish mysticism, because I think it's an idea which is really expressed in many traditions. The Eastern Orthodox Christianity, both Greek and Russian, and Coptic, have a very, very old tradition going back to Gregory of Nyssa and Maximus the Confessor, of the deification of the human. Even in the Christian West, it was a common idea amongst the early church fathers that God became man so that man could become God. The idea that the human, when fully acting on their own, can really manifest divinity. And that's a really fascinating notion to me. What I think may be unique in the Jewish perspective on that notion of the human being the conscious of the divine, and it's an idea as well, which I think I discussed in the context that Carl Jung speaks about and Jacob Burma speaks about, who's a Protestant mystic, very underappreciated mystic, I think. But the Jewish notion, I think, which ties its mysticism back to the Bible, back to the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, is how do we be the divine, is the question that the mystic poses. And that question is answered differently by every society. So in ancient Egypt, the divine is mirrored after the sun god Ra. So being a sustainer, being powerful, being the giver, being the all-knowing is how one is the divine. And the pharaoh in ancient Egypt had to put on an act of perfection. They had to, and I mean, there's discussion in Jewish literature how the pharaoh would never pee in public because he was perfect. There was nothing to excrete, and would sneak out when they needed to excrete. And like, let's say in ancient Greece, the idea of being the whoever was the top of the society was deified as well, right? So the Caesar, and sometimes very like terrible people, Caligula was a deity, right? And it meant being brutal, meant being, you know, in the image of Zeus, let's say, when it was about being conquering and being divine and taking power of war and rape, like that was the divine thing. And I think what comes in the Jewish tradition, and I think this also comes through the Christian and Muslim traditions, which of course take from that stream of Judaism directly, is the notion that God in the Bible is, although there are many personifications of God, the mystics focus specifically on the God who is a God of kindness, a God of mercy, the all-merciful, which becomes very point in Islam, the forgiving God, which becomes very point in Christianity. And it's God who tells us this, the sages say that it's God who visits the sick, clothes the naked, and buries the dead. It's three acts that God does in the Bible. With Abraham, God visits him after circumcision, and there's three specific moments where God is manifesting those traits of kindness. And for the Jewish mystic who's practicing their act of meditation, being God means not even being all powerful, not being all knowing, not being all, you know, it means being all forgiving, all loving, all concerned, all compassionate. To manifest a divine level of compassion, of humility, of love, that is how we become deified. And that's how we manifest a divine consciousness in our own lives. And I think that's a really, really powerful idea because it asks us what's the highest value which we're aspiring to. And that's and in this case, when the highest value becomes kindness and compassion, you've restructured your entire society in a different way around that aspiration.
Yeah.
Well said, beautifully said. Yeah, I think there's a really we could spend a few hours on divinity and man and our possibility and potentiality to transcend and you know, the East, you got to give it up to the East. I mean, that's the whole point, right? Is to break our mortal frame, and but really both Hinduism and Buddhism, but you know, Scott and I are doing some interesting research right now on the Gnostics and the early Christian mystics who, you know, that's what they got in trouble for, Zevi, really, is they, you know, assumed that this was, Jesus was this sword cutting through the veil, that, you know, could reveal the truth to us to embody that or to exemplify that divinity in ourselves. And, you know, the Irenaeuses, the Athanasiuses, weren't such big fans of that and burned all their books until luckily we found a couple of books in Egypt last century, which was pretty beautiful. And so now we actually have the text, which a very disappointingly low percentage of modern people are aware of, that we've like rediscovered these texts that we only heard about through correspondence from those early church fathers. But, you know, to that point, there's a lot of that might even be the fundamental question or difference between religion and spirituality or orthodoxy and mysticism at large. You know, if you could draw it out that broadly, which is unfair, but it's pretty, it's it, again, it's really refreshing for me to hear that within Jewish mysticism, that is also the goal. And maybe it might be helpful too for our audience and also probably for our team as well, Zevi, myself included, that you know, I learned so much from you about Jewish mysticism in your Zohar video. And kind of the significance of, as you said earlier, I believe the 13th century kind of codifying what a mystic is that in relation to the Zohar? I mean, I know the value of the Zohar sounds like, and the value of Jewish mysticism in the Jewish tradition seem to come out of this idea of kind of redefining God as this multiplicity, this immanency and transcendency and ineffability, right? This kind of new definition that Bronze Age humanity wasn't as clear on.
Firstly, I apologize for not making more videos on Jewish mysticism. There's something hard for me because it's so close to home and it's the topic which I know most about, really. I know how little I know, and therefore I know like I can't open my mouth to begin to talk about it. But I can so easily make a video about like a Christian mystic or like a Renaissance philosopher because I don't know how little I know.
Just
But I'm
disclaimer it
purely
with that at the top. That's all. Then you can say whatever.
yeah. It's very. It's wow. It's so. It's the thing naturally what I should be talking about most is the hardest thing to produce. But I actually do hope to be making more content on that, and I have. A lot of people have been asking for a video on the 10th Sefirot, and I did a live class, which I hope to share soon. And I hope that's helpful for people. I really do. So yeah, the concept of God, insofar as its relationship to the Zohar and the emergence of Jewish mysticism as a recognizable form in the 13th century and its contradistinction to traditional religious practice, I think is a very, very good point to talk about. And I think it's very, very often helpful to just speak directly about God, because it helps to just go from the top, and everything else flows from there, typically in theology and mysticism, which is why I'll often just skip to talking about the divine instead of talking about things on the way up. In a very rough sketch that definitely is not going to do justice to the minutiae of detail here, there's two conceptions of God that play out in mysticism and in let's say established forms of religion in all mystical traditions, let's say, besides for those that don't have a concept of God, obviously. Where in the traditional exoteric, non-mystical forms of religion, God is something which is other than us, other than the world. It's an entity which is above and beyond. It's outside. It's greater. It's the infinite, where the finite is. It's separate from us, and God creates the world. Typically ex nihilo, out of nothing, where the world is something other than God, also in the way that it comes into being. Or in some early traditions, in like let's say Greek thought, there was this sort of primordial matter which that was separate to God as well, and that from that God created the world. And but what, however it's mapped out, there's a real ontological, there's a real existential difference between God and everything else, between creator and creation. What happens in mysticism, and this probably begins in experience, but that's a separate question, is that that line gets blurred entirely, where it's no longer there's God outside, above and beyond, and we are here separate, and we are like the children to God, or we are like the servants to God. That line between God and world, between God and reality, becomes entirely blurred, because the fundamental knowledge is that everything is one and everything is God, and that there's nothing other than God. And even in the non-theistic traditions, whatever the absolute becomes, it's nothing other than that absolute. So Shunyata, whatever it is, doesn't even have to be God. God here, literally, I'm just talking about the highest principle of reality, whatever that highest principle is, becomes the all, and there's nothing besides for it. So there can be no matter, no creation, no human, no experience, no moment that's outside, that's other than God, because outside of God, nothing else exists. And this is an idea which is really fundamental to all mysticism. In Islam, they talk about God as wujud, as being, as existence. And God is the only true existence. And anything that has existence only has existence insofar as it's participating in the divine. And therefore, everything is God. And it's only a matter of us getting beyond our own veil, where we don't see the reality of God as everything, which it's only the ignorance which doesn't allow us to see that. But once we can get past that ignorance, we see how everything is really God. And for the Kabbalists, which academically is a term which begins to be used properly in the 13th century in Provence and in southern Italy and Spain, a work emerges within the first century or so of that time. It comes from, at the moment, it comes from Moshe de Leon in his school, and its antiquity is claimed to be a lot older, but as far as we can trace it back, that's historically where we can pin it to. And the Zohar is an incredible, incredible text, because it does two things with the conception of the divine based on the schema that we've just been talking about. On one hand, the Zohar is monistic, right? It posits a divine reality, which is the only reality, which is one and nothing else. And everything, insofar as it exists, partakes of that existence. And in that sense, it's standard mysticism, it's standard monism, non-dualism, perhaps even. But the Zohar, there's a term used by scholars, I just came across this recently, in some senses also post monistic, where it introduces a whole divine, a divine family. There's the father and the mother. There's like these archetypes and personas and mythical beings. It's like a whole, it's a whole, like it's a whole circus of divinity, a whole. And it seems very non-monistic. And this is actually a very interesting irony that in specifically within monistic traditions, and if you're studying Hinduism, you know this very well, that it's specifically there's a sort of a post-monistic phase where you have a whole plethora of gods. And the realization there is, I think if we wanted to boil down that sort of theology, and we speak about that at length in the Zohar video, sort of the entire mythology that's created of these interacting divine personas and it's really very colorful divinity, with intense interplay and with sexuality and with gender and with feelings, with a lot of things going on. It doesn't seem very monistic. If we wanted to translate this out of that theological language into metaphysical language, we would say like this: that true unity manifests itself and finds itself expressed specifically in the multiplicity and in the many. It's when the many can come together and be all seen as one, that's when you have real unity. Because simple unity, like a simple monism, is boring. It's like just the one, just like God pre-existence, there's nothing happening. Like God, if that's what God wanted, so to speak, God could have just not created or emanated or made anything, would have just stayed alone, sort of stayed a bachelor. But yeah. God wanted, so to speak, God wants the full plethora of life, wants the full like majesty of being, and it's specifically in that multiplicity where unity is best expressed. And this comes back to the same point as what I was saying before, that it's the monism which finds itself expressed in all of the particulars and all the details. That's the most complete harmony of divinity. And what the Zohar introduces is, and this carries on into Hasidic thought as well, where it's expressed actually more metaphysically, where I get my language from being a Hasidic Jew, where it's in the multiplicity. And what that does is that it allows us to see the divinity within the multiplicity of humanity, that every human in every shade and every color and every orientation and every gender and every inclination are all facets, all faces of the divine. And the more we can explore and the more we can embrace and the more we can experience our collective humanity, the more experiencing our collective divinity. And there's nothing within that divinity that can be rejected, or else we're rejecting the divine. There's nothing which is too ugly, which is too broken, which is too lost, which is too foregone to not be brought back into the fullness. And I think this is, I really think that these ideas, as tremendous as they are really found across the board. And I'm already thinking of like Gnostic parallels, and I'm sure you're thinking of Hindu parallels. But I that's how I would best describe the revolution in the Zoharic moment in 13th century Spain.
The phrase you used,
so beautifully said.
My favorite phrase you used in that description, I think, in one of your videos, was that it revealed a fragile plurality within God, and that it took me a while. It like washed over me, but yeah, the like you said, what would be the point? Like our existence here is the playing out of the diversity within the unity. So that's a really beautiful idea that gets represented there.
Yeah, I really honor that framework fully. I must admit, it's not Advaita. Advaita is fairly dismissive of the multiplicity. It says,
yeah,
all this mind stuff, you know, forget it. Just notice, which has its benefits, but it also has its intellectual difficulties. What comes to mind to me, what you're talking about is kind of Hinduism at large. I mean, particularly even like Vaishnavism, let's say, for example, the worship of Vishnu, the worship of Krishna. There's a form of Krishna for every preference of the devotee. So some, you know, adolescent to adults will worship Krishna as a baby, baby Gopala Krishna, and you'll see divinity in that childlike mothering quality to that. And that's the relationship that you have to the divine. Or Krishna and Arjuna, he's the counselor in the war, he's your advisor, you know, gives you insight that way. Or a lover, Krishna and Radha, and the kind of goat herding Krishna, who you know, there's a sensuality to that, and there's a romance to that, and a divine relationship. And so, you know, I think one of the real beauties of Hinduism, there's so many to me, but you know, this idea that they're all masks of the one, you know, and that's kind of what I got from you in that read of like this family and this pantheon. And some of what you said too reminded me a lot of a term that I've only really heard it. You say, and a couple of like professors and academics say, which is panentheism.
Yeah.
Is what that reminded me of. So a lot of people, for our listeners, might be familiar with that term pantheism, that God is in everything. But there was this guy, Charles Hartshorne, and a couple others. I think Alfred North Whitehead, who introduced panentheism, inserting that en between pan and theism to imply transcendence, to imply that not only is God everything, but there's also this transcendental quality. Like it was explained to me that like the simile might be like we are able to move our bodies and transcend them as the soul. God's body is the universe, but God transcends the universe as well. Something like that. So I got that flavor from you in that discussion. Yeah. That was really beautiful.
Panentheism is a very important term for the Hasidic Jew, because most academics label most of Hasidic theology as panentheistic. Just in terms of what Scott said, I want to talk about panentheism for a second. But the divine fragility is actually an interesting expression, because in the Kabbalistic mythos, and I love the mythologies of mysticism, which is why also Gnosticism is so epic, because they have such a cool mythos. Yeah. Sophia and the variations of the mythology are really I was very influenced by Joseph Campbell when I began my studies, and which is a term
we're all Campbell heads.
Awesome. Yeah, so the masks is a very Campbellian term. And he really gets into, so in the Kabbalistic mythos there is actually a stage in creation where reality, or the divine moment, that hypostasis shatters, and that's the term that's used. It's shvira in Hebrew, and it's seen as our job throughout. We're sort of built in the next iteration of reality, where the shattered shards have fallen into, and it's our job to go around and collect those broken pieces of divinity and to bring them back together so they can be reunited in a more perfect union. A fragile and shattered divinity is a very Jewish Kabbalistic thing in that sense, which in some ways very interesting links up with a Christian notion where there's a suffering and fragile divinity as well, where God is embodied in the form of Jesus, which is an interesting parallel. On panentheism is a very important point. The genealogy goes back a bit further. It's a term which emerges out of 19th century Germany. I think it may have been I have a video.
Somebody who was reading Schopenhauer, probably.
Yeah, for sure. Was it Schelling or one of them? Anyhow, but it was a very important notion for Whitehead, who I absolutely love. I mean, I can't understand him, he's way beyond me, but I love Alfred Whitehead. I think he's a mystic through and through. And he's a great example as well of a deeply, deeply rigorous thinker who's also deeply mystical. But and I really hope to find time to make content about all these incredible people.
Yeah,
so that I can learn about them.
But let's shift into a YouTube channel here shortly. But you can, finish your thought on the concept.
Panentheism is very important for the Hasidic Jew, because panentheism, as you said, is basically pantheism is the belief that everything is God, pantheos. And panentheism means that everything is God and in God, which maintains space for divine transcendence, as you say. And it's a very, very classic Jewish idea that God is the place of the world, but the world is not the place of God. Where this all is God, but it's not the full extent of the divine. There's more to it. There's more to the mystery than we can just comprehend or see. And that's a very important idea in Jewish mysticism, and therefore panentheism is a helpful jargon to frame that.
Yeah.
Very perennialist opportunism to just nab that one and say, hey, that lines up with what we've been doing.
Yeah, sure, for sure.
One thing we could maybe talk about too as we shift into the second half of the episode with Zevi is practical usage. That's something that, I think all of us are focused on individually. It's something Ryan talks a lot about, Melina talks a lot about. Zevi is, that was kind of one of your taglines of the show, is like kind of, what's the point of all the, of knowing this? How is it helpful? And I was talking to a family member recently about just working in with spiritual content and just talking about like the global pandemic. To your point earlier, this is a really challenging time for all of humanity. And, you know, we're kind of seeing, I'm really seeing kind of two things happen. One is that the economic effects and the economic social impact is, you know, a lot of people are suffering with that. They're depressed. You know, there's a lot of down folks about what's going on, and it's, you know, it's affecting all of us as a collective trauma. But secondarily, there is more interest in spiritual concepts. There was a survey recently that was related to Michael Shermer, I think in the Skeptic magazine, and that whole scene of like taking kind of religious surveys of people. And it looks like spiritual interest is up in 2020 by several percentage points. People are kind of looking for answers, right? And so, you know, let's talk about that. I mean, how has this stuff affected your all these concepts, these ideas, practices, book learning? How has it impacted your mental health and emotional well-being, Zevi?
Yeah, that's a very real question. You mentioned Ryan. I'm actually most scared of Ryan now because they say like the silentest person in the room is like the absolute, like the one who just is like,
just listening, just waiting.
Yeah. No need to be afraid.
yeah. So I'm hearing like a few kind of different questions. So maybe we'll just explore them together. Firstly, I think that mysticism, if it's just a matter of like, you know, theory building and mental acrobatics, is great. It's fun. It's entertaining, but it's a pretty much waste of time. Mysticism has to comprise of three components, which is experience, theory, and practice. And the real fruit of mysticism is in the practice. And the practice means both one's own internal spiritual practice, how they're working on themselves to be a better person, be closer to nature, to the one, to others around them. And practicism means how we then go live our lives forward, knowing what we know and having experienced what we experienced. And it's a very simple equation in my mind for the mystic. It's a very simple equation, but it's deceptively simple because the demand that it makes upon us is absolutely titanic. And the equation is like this. If the mystic believes that everything is one and that there's nothing which is really other than anything else, then everything that I encounter is in a real, very deep way, both part of me and divine. And therefore I must treat everything that I encounter with the same love, devotion, and compassion which I would treat myself. Which is so easy to say. It's so easy to say, but to actually live that way and to actually do it is a whole nother story. And it's easy as well, perhaps, to do it with strangers, right? You could just encounter a stranger and just shower them with love. But try the people closest to you. Try your family members. Try your roommates. Try your spouse. Try your child. Try your parent. It's a really, really high demand. So that's in terms of the ethical demand. And in my mind, that is the absolute zenith of mysticism. And that is what we all must aim to aspire to. And it's that where we invest. And I think that the mystic has this idea, when put into practice, has implications for society, for economies, for our conceptions of ownership, for possession, for like it's totally revolutionary. It's absolutely revolutionary. And I think that it's something which we're coming to discover is not only revolutionary and incredibly difficult and challenging, it's also now becoming necessary, because we can no longer live in the world under the false impression that we're separate entities that can live as islands without impacting one another. That way of living, economically, globally, environmentally, we've seen where that leads, and it's not leading to a sustainable reality anytime soon, and we're destroying ourselves and each other and the earth in the process. So this shift that needs to happen is a shift that needs to happen. It's the existential demand for the moment that we need to move into that state of consciousness. Up until now, you could say historically that waking up or seeing ourselves as part of a united organism called earth, called nature, called God, that may have been somewhat of a luxury, but now it's a necessity. Now it's an existential necessity. And that's just on a global level. On a personal, on a private level, I think as well, I think that, I mean, I, to be honest here and to be human and to be open, I struggle a lot with loneliness. It's like something which I've struggled with for a long time. I grew up in somewhat of an isolated community because I was like there in a community representing a larger international organization, but amongst the Australians, I wasn't an Australian, I was an outsider, I was a Jew, I was an other. And there was a lot of like social loneliness. And then throughout, I like, it's something which I've been grappling with and trying to bring these ideas to myself, trying to bring to realization the idea that we're somehow united and that we can feel communion with the things around us, with the nature around us, with the animals around us, with the people that we can unite with over our, you know, through our minds and through our awareness, that we can unite with through bonds of love and compassion, which thank God there are. These things have a real power to really alleviate a lot of the things that we all go through. And for me, that's my own struggle. And for some other people struggle with anxiety and with guilt and with depression and with you know, there's a whole host of ailments which humans suffer from, which are all very real and very difficult. And one of my favorite sort of cliche lines from mysticism is they asked the Buddha, what did you, like the Buddha was a prince, according to at least one version of the story, and he gave up everything. He gave up, you know, the kingdom, the royal family, the women. He gave it all up to go like sit under a tree as far as the plain naked eye could see. And they asked the Buddha, like, what did you gain in giving away like all of your wealth, all of your riches, all of your robes? And he said, actually, I gained nothing, but I lost a lot of things. I lost my fear. I lost my uncertainty. I lost my anxiety. I lost my guilt. I lost my jealousy. I lost my rage. I lost my anger. And these are all things which as we begin to work these ideas through us, the simple notion that we're all really one and we're not here in competition with one another. We're all here to thrive and live beautiful lives of harmony. And these aren't just like idealistic, flowery slogans. These are real things that we can implement into our lives and begin to practice in our relationships. And when we begin to do those things, we change our paradigms and we change our relationships. And it's so easy to fall back into a place of separation, into a place of ego, into a place of pride and jealousy and anger and comparison and judgment. But the more we can influence ourselves and people, for me it's through books and through reading and the more I encounter mm-hmm. these ideas and real to me, and the more I spend time in contemplation and in silence, reading for me is a very spiritual practice. I'll just plug this book here. I've been reading. It's Ram Dass, which I know that you're a fan of. And I mean, I was reading this. I'm right now in quarantine. I'm right now like really like blown this up in my life because I'm forced to be alone. People that I've been in contact with, they came out with the virus. So I'm here in quarantine. I feel fine, thank God. I feel really great. But so being alone for 2 weeks is like a very, very, yes. It's a very difficult experience, but like this book has been with me through the experience. And reading about the stories of service and of selflessness and of kindness and of pain and suffering, like I feel less alone. I feel united with these people, and I feel like I can take this opportunity of silence to work on myself. And wow, I'm like, if there's anyone that needs working on it, it's me. Like,
but, so beautifully said, Zevi. Thank you for sharing all that. I was just gonna say, how fortunate for you. You stumbled into the perfect antidote for loneliness, which is the realization that you are everything.
Yeah.
What and a supreme antidote to anything.
Even after you make that realization, it takes a lot of time. I mean, in Jewish mysticism, we talk about chachma and das. There's like conceptual knowledge, and there's knowledge as it sits like deep in your throat and deep in your heart. Sure. And moving that realization down is really where the work is. So that's the work.
So true.
Beautifully said. I really appreciate the vulnerability in talking about the loneliness. I apologize for my silence. My internet has been kind of in and out. But also, much of the kind of philosophizing tends to bring me up into my head a bit, and in an effort to kind of feel back into my body. I mean, I really felt deeply connected to you when you shared that, so I really appreciate it. And if I'm something that I'm just feeling and wanting to ask is something I've been feeling this conversation is, I'd love to hear about, you know, maybe a moment. It sounds like you're in quarantine, which I know is difficult. I had to quarantine as well back in October, but I'd love to hear about a moment in the last, like, you know, maybe a couple of weeks that you experienced something that was extremely blissful, or just a moment, the first moment that comes to you of, you know, bliss or deep love that you've experienced lately.
Firstly, I really like appreciate and respect your choice to like not engage in the parts of the conversation which you felt like wouldn't have done anything good for you. Like respect, and also like thank you for sharing that, that like my vulnerability found a place with you. I really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
In response to your question, I have like a pretty short term memory, and I tend to only remember like what happened recently to me. So I can talk about like this past weekend. I'm like a practicing Jew, and which means that every Friday night at sunset, all electronics get shut off, and it stays that way until the moon and stars come out Saturday night, which for me is like, for me is absolutely incredible because I'm so bad. All of my work and like my leisure all happens like through my computer, all my communication now. I can like wake up and be on my screen from morning till night, and it's horrendous. It like, it kills me, and I need to be better with my tech hygiene, and I'm sure we all need to work on that. But but comes Shabbat, comes Saturday, and it's like hard, cold turkey, no technology, no screens, no phones, and you really have to, like, it's a really different way of being. Time, like, time itself is augmented. I have no clocks down.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
How do you check your texts?
it's such a crazy thing to do, but I actually think that people, like, regardless of like whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist or atheist, they should like take a day to make a Shabbat, a tech Shabbat for them. It's something which is picking up a bit of steam in the States, like a secular Shabbat. So for me, this past Shabbat was a really like incredible experience because, like as usual, I had no devices set up, and I'm also like alone, and like I wasn't visiting anyone. No one was visiting me. Like, also like on Shabbat, typically it's a very communal, very families get together, friends get together. Like, you never do things alone on Shabbat. You eat like these big long meals. Like Friday night, you can go for like 3-4 hours. Shabbat day, equally long. Then it was like, and there's very specific things you do. There's like a cup of wine, and there's the challah, like the bread that we make. And I did the whole Shabbat just by myself. Like, I sat down with a cup of wine. I said the Kiddush, like sanctifying, like speaking about the verses in Genesis, how God creates the world and sanctifies the day. And it was a very, I honestly felt just a tremendous amount of gratitude to firstly, to have the physical space to be sheltered and to be protected and be provided for, to have like friends that thought of me in advance and called me up on Thursday and be like, hey Zevi, can we send you food for Shabbat? We know that you can't go out to the supermarket and buy things. They like went out and catered my whole Shabbat. So being surrounded by love and being surrounded by kindness, and then being able to like really just spend the time with myself. And then from within that space to really like think about the people who I love in my life and to really, you know, send my love to them, because I know that everyone's struggling during this time. And being able to like to tap into a space where I could be totally simultaneously on my own and totally alone and totally isolated, but still feel so supported and held and with people. That's been a very beautiful experience just this past weekend.
That sounds amazing.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. I'm very fascinated by that. And my question when you were first talking about it was like, is this normally a communal time then?
100%.
Since you're kind of, there's no devices, but I can imagine that being stuck in quarantine kind of flips it on its head a little bit and provides a really beautiful opportunity for some self-inquiry and connecting to yourself, you know?
It was probably the first like Shabbat that I've done myself in my life.
Wow.
Cool.
Wow.
What a unique experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
You talked about, or we t you talked about in the interview with a Sufi. Remind me his name. I'm sorry, I should have
Name
remembered.
is Ishan.
İzhan, talked about
Yes.
how Ramadan was iftar at the end of Ramadan was virtual last year. Might be again this year, it looks like, probably. And so that's happening across the Abrahamic traditions, across really all faith traditions that have such a communal component. So empathy to those systems that rely on each other, and may all of you and may all beings find that connectivity despite.
And
I'm
we also get to
really.
see,
Oh, go
sorry.
ahead.
We also get to see how, like, typically, like, when, like, the Jew will do their Pesach and the Muslim will do their Ramadan and the Christian will do their Easter, whatever it is, and we see them very separately and they don't have much to do. But now, like, socially and like technologically, we're all kind of experiencing the our own realities in the same way, which is an interesting introspection and union. Like, I can understand what it means, even though I've never experienced a post Ramadan meal. I can understand what it means to be doing things which would otherwise be done communally over technology. So that's a point again of unity.
I'm really curious. I don't
Definitely.
know, too much about Hasidic Judaism, and I'm really curious about what your kind of daily, just kind of daily rituals, daily practices are, and then also what kind of community you have where you are. I mean, are you surrounded by any sort of family, or is it mostly just friends? And to what extent are they involved with your spiritual practice?
So that's a really fascinating question, and I can answer only for myself. I can't speak like for anyone else in the Hasidic community.
Sure.
Everyone's individual experience is different, and every community is different for sure.
I feel like that's a useful disclaimer for all answers to all questions. I can only speak for myself. I don't speak for anyone.
So it's also the only thing that we have like jurisdiction and authority to speak about,
Exactly.
right?
So. It's interesting in terms of the Hasidic community, in terms of thinking about like daily ritual. It's actually, I mean, I can sort of look as an outsider and say, oh yeah, that's ritual, that's ritual, that's ritual. And I'm like somewhat of a someone who's studying religions. I understand like the way that religious practice is conceptualized and how it's different from secular practice, the distinction between like sacred and profane and whatever other scholarly jargon we'll use. But for me, as an insider growing up, I never saw these things as ritual. I never saw them as religious practice. There is, for someone who's a practicing Jew, there is no religion even. It's just your way of life. It's just who you are. So like for example, like I'm wearing a kippah, like a yarmulke in Yiddish, and to me it's not an act of devotion. It's not an act of religious expression. Like obviously, if you ask me, I'll say yeah, sure. It's an act of identification. It's an act of this, and it represents that and that. But it's not. It's an article of clothing, and it's I've been wearing it as much as I've been wearing t-shirts and socks like my entire life. So it's so I don't think about these things ritually. But to take a step back and to look at from the outsider, so the Hasidic Jew, and Hasidic Jew is just one strain as well of contemporary what's called Orthodox Jewry, which is a term which I really don't like. But there are many other practicing Jews, halachic Jews, whatever it is. So the day begins. It's the Jewish life is heavily, having just said what I said, Jewish life is heavily, heavily ritualized, and literally every single moment of the Jewish day, there is something Jewish to be doing in that moment. And I'm not saying that hyperbolically. I'm saying that very, very literally. There's from the moment you wake up and take your first breath as an infant to the moment you close your eyes as a dying human, there's a Jewish thing to be doing that entire time, and before and after. And this is kind of the what we spoke about before about this deep holistic integration between Jewish life and practice, where there's no moment which is void or vacuum from that. So the very first thing, so funnily enough, Judaism sees time differently. We have a different we have a lunar calendar as opposed to a solar calendar, but also the way we see days, we don't see the day beginning in the morning. And many Jews won't even know this because Jews are so like westernized and secularized and Christianized. The Jewish day does not begin in the morning. The Jewish day begins sundown, what we think is the day before. And that's true for all of Judaism. Ask your Jewish
Oh.
friend. Ask your Jewish date. When does the day of getting accepted to Judaism? And
My Jewish
it's
friends
really
probably don't know
based.
Same.
It goes all the way back to Genesis, where the verse in Genesis says, "Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, yom rishon." And it was evening. It was morning, day one. And it was evening. It was morning, day two. And from then on, it's evening then morning. It's not morning evening. The same way that like Sunday, whatever. But so the Jewish day begins with and psychologically as well, there's something very important here, because the way you go to sleep is the way you wake up, right? There's an old Yiddish expression, if you go to sleep like a horse, you wake up like a horse, right? And people that make sort of plans in their mind, be like, tomorrow I'm gonna do this, tomorrow I'm gonna quit smoking, tomorrow,
New
there's no
day.
tomorrow, it's now, it's today. It's today or never. So the Jewish day begins when the sun goes down. And there's a lot of, across spiritual traditions in the world, there's a lot of significance in moments of transition. And that's in equinoxes, that's in life cycles, but it's also in sunrise and sunset. And there are moments where we can step out and see the bigger picture, see the divine dance. We can see the sun doing its thing again. And we can see, and Judaism sees the sun going down as an act of worship, as an act of praise, as an act of love. And what we do is we stop and we pray. So Jews pray three times a day. There's Mincha, Ma'ariv, and Shacharit. So the Jewish day begins with the Mincha Ma'ariv prayer, and it's really just a time to center, to focus. It's a time of most of the prayer is done silently. Usually it's done with a group of people. Now it's done independently because Corona, which is also an experience. And then there are a bunch of other things throughout the day. The end of the day, the way that the Jew eats, whenever a Jew takes a bite of food, we first say a blessing. It's one short line in Hebrew. And it depends based on what you're eating, it's a different blessing. So you have to be basically conscious and think about what you're eating and stop and actually realize and like say thank you, which is an incredible
Wow,
thing. You just
yeah,
stick
it's
your mouth.
amazing.
You
Love
stop and
that.
you say like Baruch Atah Hashem, okay, whatever it is you're saying. And depending on what you're eating and what you're blessing is a different blessing. And when you finish eating, there's also a blessing as well. And these are also the best way I think to think about them is that we can go through life living unconsciously, just sort of on autopilot, or we can be forced to like here's a moment where we're forced to come back and to be present again and to remember and to be grateful and to be humble.
Yeah,
that intentionality, right?
yeah,
Like
yeah,
it's a beautiful practice.
Yeah,
that's a
and that's
very, very
hugely
popular.
missing from so many people that live on kind
Yeah.
of autonomous thought. And I'm getting a lot of like Buddhist flavor from what you're talking about. Like in Zen, they talk a lot about mindful eating and
Yes.
just not doing anything else. We always like watch TV or we're on the computer, we're eating, or even with another person, you're having a conversation, but just eating, just being with
Yeah.
that, with the
Yeah.
food, with the
Yeah.
morsels, you know, it's
Which is
very
an incredible
helpful.
experience if you're able to be that, right?
Yeah.
And these are very deep, very old Jewish ideas. And people are beginning to realize just how healthy these ideas are, just purely on like an empirical level. And I think like you don't even need to be religious or Jewish or even believe in God to do these. You can be a complete materialistic atheist and be like, hey, I want to take a moment to think about like how did this get from the farm, from the orchard to my plate? Who are the people that were involved in making that happen? And so
Yeah.
bring consciousness and appreciation to that process.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another just I'm sort of there's actually there's like so much that happens in Jewish day. I'm just like the highlight.
Yeah.
Before we go to sleep, we say Shema, which is like a Jewish declaration of faith, and it actually by the Kabbalists it's read as a declaration of the unity of God and unity of existence. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. Which is read in all sorts of fancy, interesting Kabbalistic ways, but basically the notion that God is all there is, and that being is unified, and there's a moment during that prayer where we're supposed to make what's called cheshbon hanefesh, which is an accounting of our day, to think about how we've been, to think about how we are, to think about how we're putting ourselves to sleep, and at the end we say a final prayer, and we say biyadcha kibruchi, that into your hands, O God, I give my spirit, which is what happens when we sleep. It's an act of surrendering. It's an act of trust. And we'll wake up in the morning and get our spirit back from God, renewed, refreshed. And when we say the final prayer, we don't speak anymore. There's no more talking until you're asleep. And the next words that come out of your mouth, and when you wake up, and I mean, talking about like the Jewish law tells you like which side of your body to sleep on, and like it's really very, very, very, very
Wow.
Prescriptive.
very prescriptive. Yeah, we don't sleep on our backs, we don't sleep on our stomachs out of for fascinating reasons. And the next words that come out of your mouth, you say modani. You say modani. I give gratitude to you. Like the cosmic energy, God of the universe, whatever, however you want to translate it. That you return my spirit to me with great kindness and trust. I'll like make good use of it for the day, essentially, is what it means. We then wash our hands in the morning, Netilat Yadayim, where we cleanse our hands physically. And the whole day continues with this. There's the longest prayer of the Jewish day is then in the morning is Shacharit. Where Jewish men typically will wrap tefillin and sit in prayer anywhere from half an hour to an hour to an hour and a half. And again, it's just a moment of silence, of introspection, of one would think that like you're spending so much time, in silence and in contemplation and in meditation. Like, when do you have any time to do anything? Like, you're just going to be like wasting your whole day in prayer, but it's not true. Like, the days that I like start on the right foot and I set my intention and I clear my mind and I'm able to like focus on the present, like it pays off. Like in leaps and bounds, because I know
Absolutely.
who I am for the day. I know why I'm here. I know what I'm doing. I'm centered. I'm grounded. I have a mission. And otherwise, I mean, you can think that you're saving an
Beautiful.
hour by just like skipping a moment, an hour of prayer, but the rest of your day, you're a scattered person. And
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I manage to do it right every day. And some days, like I don't have the energy and I don't do it, and I brush it off and I pay for the consequences. But there's always a new day to go at it fresh and new. The Jewish day goes on and on and on, and I'd be happy to continue.
No, that's cool.
I'm
That's really
sure
amazing.
that it gives you a sense of it.
I really appreciate, the insight into that. I'm very fascinated by it, and I love, as Bob mentioned, the intentionality behind it. It to me, in my experience, is kind of a the foundation of a spiritual practice, right? Is to be intentional as often as possible. And it sounds like your practice is pretty regimented in that way, which is really, really beautiful.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for that purpose. Yeah. No,
One thing
I
that
just wanted to say like how great it's been to hear about just your experience and just learning more. I've been an absolute fly on the wall this entire conversation, just so that I can continue to be that sponge of learning. Because transparently did not know nearly as much as I do now about Jewish mysticism and philosophy and just the day-to-day. So I just wanted to echo Ryan in that. So thank you for educating me.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I would just add to that quickly to say, as we get to the close, we're doing some like neurological research in the Mindfulness Club. We're looking at like brain functionality and I promise I'll make it relevant not to do a hard pivot into neurology, but basically in neuroscience, basically there's this term called neuroplasticity. And that is very cool because what that means is your neural patterns are changeable and they get stronger based on repeated patterns. And so within psychology and the history of psychology and psychoanalysis, the idea was like an adult can't change your habits or modify your beliefs and behaviors. And this research has just destroyed that. We're constantly changing our neural patterns. And so kind of being intentional, having a regular meditation practice, having these types of behaviors and habits in our life, you get better at them. They get stronger actually, even materially. Not only is it something mentally and like builds your habits that way, it actually translates into brain patterns and connects different hemispheres and so on. And I think that we didn't quite talk about, maybe we'll have to save it for later because you're gonna have to come back. But the capacity of like almost like instantaneous enlightenment versus like incremental advances is something that's interesting to me because it's like it's extremely incremental to me. Like, it's hardly noticeable to me. You know, I've seen some benefits. I've been doing this 10, 12 years as far as meditating and reading these books and listening to these teachers. And I've felt more peace, but I still get angry at the guy and the delivery driver that got, you know, it's like, I'm not there. But I know I'm not there, and I've made some gains and I have some opportunities, but, you know, what it sounds like to me, this kind of whole daily ritual, process does sound like a really beautiful way to do that, to, you know, create this really structured incremental growth towards a more harmonious, you know, I think to use your words, like integration of all this book learning, Zevi, that you've been doing into your daily life and into your daily behaviors. So thank you for sharing. And I think for me and maybe the rest of the team and any listeners, like, I just kind of realized how intentionless I am. You know, I want to re-examine my day from this lens a bit more thoroughly. And
it's inspiring. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's deeply inspiring. It reminds me of, I was watching this show on Hulu, Rami. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know very much about, you know, Islam, a decent amount, but like that show really just gave me a little bit of insight into like the daily practices and what that looks like. And it actually inspired me to have a more daily regimented, just ritualistic practice. Like, I want to, you know, have, you know, multiple moments of silence, not just one, you know, and trying to incorporate that more. So it's really inspiring to hear that intentionality of your practice. And I agree, it like makes me be like, okay, I want to step it up a little bit. So
it's also really reassuring too, just to hear your experience of having just the daily moments of even recognizing when you're not in the right headspace or that you might not have the time, you know, and how, you know, you said pay the consequences later. I feel like I've definitely been there where I'm just like, I don't have time to sit and meditate for the hour or for 30 minutes even. And psychologically, I think that I'm saving myself time, but I'm a lot less in the moment throughout the rest of my day, which, you know, I end up being, so really interesting to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I come away from conversations like these recommitted to my own practice. So thank you for allowing me what I need to be doing. That was a great quote. I wish I could remember who it was from. They said that, that it goes without saying that the way you spend your days is the way you spend your life, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we have a bit of like cognitive like switch where it's like, oh no, I'm doing this like now, like this, I'll do this for a few weeks or a few months so that I could be doing that later. It's like, no, this is your life now.
This is your
like,
life. The way you're spending this is days, it. This is your today. And your life.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
That's so real.
Yeah. There's even one thing too that kind of hit me is like, you know, we're in similar spaces, like as content creators, like just to zoom back and be even more like self inquiring here. You know, you're talking about academic mysticism. That's kind of what we hit. I think you found my mystic, demystifying mystic philosophy article, which is like pretty academic. And that's also Scott's title, by the way. Isn't that brilliant? Demystifying mystic philosophy. I was like, I need a title for this. It's like explaining mysticism. And Scott was like, how about demystifying mystic philosophy? Anyway, yeah, that's how good he is. But, you know, being in this space of like talking about religion and spirituality in an academic way isn't as like appealing, like from like a clicks perspective, and like, and what a dredge to bring up CTRs, but you know, the whole like there is an aspect of like marketing mysticism, which like we've all kind of like laughed about, and like I think actually, you know, the last half hour of our last 20 minutes of us talking about the practical usage of like that is really actually appealing to people to learn how to like transform their own day to day. Most of the stuff I think that does really well in the spiritual content space is, it's almost like framed as like life hack or like brain hack or like, it's like brain hack, pray every 3 days, you know, it's like, actually it's this, but, we're masking it in terms of, you know, more dense theory and so on. So I don't know, just
Yeah. No,
observation of content.
you know what's funny? I'm so bad at thinking about like what's gonna be
I know.
marketable, what's gonna happen to create. Like for me, I think like everyone's fascinated by what I'm fascinated in. So if I post like Schelling and Hegel, like where they disagreed, like their comparative idealism, like yeah, like people, that's gonna be fire.
Is Schopenhauer Buddhist? Like I was like I've never cl my finger hurt.
So yeah, so I have no I like I make content for the way I see it is like I'm making content for myself like a few years or months ago,
Yeah, that's cool.
so I'm like
That's a cool idea.
audience in some sense, but
What
when
I've
I need help I'm
recently
like making some
discovered.
maybe I'll go to my sister. She's like really good with words. She's like really good with like psychology and what people want to see and
Yeah,
what.
like copywriting
And
is what we're
I'll
learning.
give her like here's like my whole like list of like different titles I'm thinking about, and it's like all very technical, like very all the good jargon. And she's like, no. Just why blah blah. That's
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Zevi, close us out with I mean, this is going to be impossible, but I feel like one to three books that you would recommend, popular to obscure. I know you could recommend 45 books in the next hour, but we just like to, and we that's like our formulaic, and this is kind of like a celebration of literature as well.
Wow. I was so hoping that you would forget to ask that question.
Because you have way too many. You can run through a bunch if you want. I just
No,
thought
no. I'll
some
try
big
bringing down.
ones.
I'm so down about celebrating literature. Books are like my best friends, really. And I think it's such an important way that we pass like wisdom around. I was thinking of, okay, this is what I was thinking in advance. I was thinking of William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. You don't have to read the whole book, just read the introduction, like the one or two chapters on mysticism and his conversion experience and his conclusion. Because he brings such a clear thinking perspective and really is just so he's so ahead of his time on seeing where this trend is going in a way that's not he's not like evangelical and enthusiastic, and he's like just really he's a very very rigorous pragmatist. He's a psychologist, and he's like, guys, like this is good shit right here, and we should be getting on this. So William James Varieties of
I
Religious
gotta say
Experience.
really quickly, I learned William James from Ram Dass. He quotes
Wow.
that quote about apply the flimsiest stimuli, and I
Yes.
can't find it, but it's like that famous William James quote.
Yeah.
And he goes, ironically, I was teaching Harvard in William James Hall that they
Wow.
fired me from
Ha.
when I was
Wow.
doing exactly what he
That's
Oh
kind of
my
Yeah.
gosh. Wow, that's amazing.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. That's yeah. So that the thinnest film separates our everyday consciousness from other forms of perception, and no account of reality is complete without it. Blah blah blah.
Yeah, and apply the
Wow.
flimsiest stimuli, and there you are in
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
accessing
So
that
he himself was doing
stimulation.
that. He himself had some nitrous oxide, which is what was doing that for him. So that's one book I would recommend, and I think it's very universal and a very easy book. And I mean, easy me yeah, it's like it's accessible, I think. The other book I would say I'm a big fan of the writing and thinking of Aldous Huxley. I'm looking I actually want to make a video sort of looking at his own intellectual trajectory through his writings. Through he went blind at one point. He has a very, very fascinating life story, and I've really enjoyed much of his literature. He has, I mean, the typical book that's recommended is The Perennial Philosophy, which is a great book. It definitely has its flaws, but I think for someone that's looking to get into these things, it's a really good introduction. He goes thematically through different traditions, and he just brings bits of wisdom from everywhere. It's definitely he there's definitely parts that he missed and all kinds of technical critiques, but a good book nonetheless. Along with that, if I can slip some
Doors.
more in his Doors of Perception, Heaven and Hell, where he writes about his masculine experience, and his power and command over the prose of the English language is just really like second to none. So that's a delightful read. And the third, I have a third book to put in. Maybe I'll leave it at those two.
That's great.
It's tricky for me because I want to recommend all kinds of scholarly books, but people that aren't so interested in the scholarship, people may have, and I'm sure it's been recommended 100 times, like Ram Dass's Be Here Now, or like Eckhart Tolle.
Beware How the show. Like, it's very
yeah, exactly. for me personally, actually, like, those books, like, don't do it for me, and I prefer like the, you know what?
I'll give one. How can I help? I even recommend more than Be Here Now these days, but yeah.
The one scholarly book that I'll put out for people, because I just came across this recently, Rudolf Studstill, who's a, wow. Now that I mentioned this, there's more I want to say. just two more. David Loy, Non-Duality, is a fantastic comparative philosophy of Eastern non-duality, where he looks, and that's really, and you guys, if you haven't read that, you guys must read that. You will love that. And Rudolf Studstill has a book called Unity of Mystical Traditions, where he's comparing the German mystics, the sort of the Reinhardt mystics, so Eckhart, Suso, and Tuller, with Dogen and Bonn in the East, Buddhist traditions. So and he goes actually through like the whole academic debate around like constructivism and perennialism and Staes and Katz and that whole very fascinating debate, and then he puts forth a really fascinating sort of comparative schema for mysticism. If someone's a bit more tickled by notes and citations, check that book out. You'll love it.
And we'll link to all of these. Zevi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been like a learning explosion, hour and a half, definitely on my end. So thank you so much.
Yes.
And we'll be in touch, man. We're just kind of doing too much similar, very, very similar circles. So
I hope
gratitude.
I hope the rest of your quarantine brings fruitful experiences for you. And I hope that when you're done with it, you get to celebrate with at least a few friends.
Yes.
And
yes.
Cool.
And maybe virtually with us.
Yeah.
Or Texas.
I love that.
Firstly, thank you guys so much for having me on. It was such a delight. It was so nice to talk to people that are on the path together. And yes, we're both fighting this war together, this war of love and peace. And I'm so glad. It's funny actually, because you emailed me and I never saw it, because the emails that were going through my website were actually just staying in the website. They weren't being forwarded to my inbox. And I found like emails, and I saw your email actually like really later, but I also messaged you independently. Like, we both messaged each other like this. And what we're doing is
several
doing
different
is,
dimensions we were going to connect in. So
yeah, absolutely. Like, the work that we're doing has like, what we're doing is beautifully different and unique, which there's space for everyone in this field, and there's so much more. And like, trying to invite more people to create as well in this space. Yeah. But we're doing work which is so aligned, and I would love to continue working with you guys. I'd love to continue collaborating. I'd love to have you guys. I'd love if you send me this clip when you're releasing, so I can also release a clip so I can drive my.
Yeah, totally.
That's awesome.
We're really in this together. And we all grow together, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then it makes us feel less lonely all the time, because we all feel that.
Yeah, it's so nice to have allies. So thank you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet you, Zevi.
Total pleasure.